For decades, the home has been a place of high technology. Companies selling home appliances, from mixers to microwaves, have promised to ease the burden of housework and to help us to be better cooks, better cleaners, and so on. The sales pitch was, and often still is, that technology rescues us from the dull work of the house, leaving more time for what makes a house a home, the bonds of relationships, and the pursuit of life's pleasures. After decades of experimentation in research labs and testbeds, a new paradigm of technology is now emerging on the market. And this paradigm is Internet of Things, or IoT. Loosely sketched, Internet of Things posits a world in which all kinds of things are interconnected. They're able to talk to each other. And they form an infrastructure on which new services can be created. But what is it like to live with Internet of Things? What new ways of being together will Internet of Things enable? Welcome to MedeaVox. My name is Clint Heyer. I'm a senior lecturer in interaction design here at Malmö University. With me today is Anuradha Reddy and David Kotalis, both PhD candidates in interaction design with a special interest in Internet of Things.
Hello.
Hey.
David, some of the most prominent IoT products for the home involve installing a bunch of different devices in the homes. Sensors, for example, installed in different rooms, hubs placed in central location, and so on. What do you think of the implications are of this kind of infrastructure?
Implications are kind of double. On the one hand, you have this issue that you have old buildings that might need to install new things, and that might be very cumbersome and complicated. On the other hand, since we don't really have standards on which are the pre-established communication methods for any kind of sensor, building a new home, embedding some sort of technology is forcing you to, you know, stick to that one technology. So the implications are, I think they're still to be seen, but as for now, what's happening is that it's stopping the faster development of this technology.
So this infrastructure limits use in particular cases?
Well, if you give a thought about what you need to install something that's going to be permanently operating in your home, you're going to need something that's trustworthy, and that's as invisible as possible. You don't want big devices to be hanging from your walls that will be destroying the effort that you put in decorating your home environment, right? Mm-hmm. So then you're going to be having devices that will most likely have to be close to things like power plugs or other locations because you need to power them up for a while. And also, if you want to install them just separately from the power plugs, like, for example, like you install an Ethernet network in an office space, then you also need to make a pretty large investment in refurbishing your location or your place to include these extra communication buses.
And would that kind of infrastructure exclude certain types of people or certain kind of home situations from participating in Internet of Things?
Well, in my opinion, I don't think it's excluding from a point of view of the installation itself. It's excluding from the point of view that it costs money and that it takes some time to implement. So for people that are living in a more temporarily situation, they will never do such an installation. It's like if you're renting a house, for example, you will never be taking care of mounting an irrigation system in the garden because you're just renting the house. While if the house is yours, you will, of course, invest in that kind of construction.
And in the same way that we make a house into a home by making it comfortable and an intimate sort of a space, might it be that selecting and installing Internet of Things infrastructure could be a part of that? So some way of making this physical structure feel like a home?
Yeah, well, it's my belief that we're going to be incorporating digital devices more and more into our preferred set of artifacts. We already saw this through the mobile phone. The one difference is that mobile phone is an item that we always carry with ourselves, and it's to some extent, it's something that we like to show to others. The same thing as our laptop computers, right? It's an item that we carry with us, and we're going to be seen with this device, and it's going to become part of our identity. On the other hand, these devices on the Internet of Things, they are supposed to be just providing us with extra information, mostly the sensor part of it. So you don't really want the IoT per se to be seen. It has to be something invisible, ubiquitous, and pervasive to some extent. So it's going to be there for you. So the question is whether an IoT device per se, because of being IoT, is going to really be something that we're going to be liking to see in our homes.
Anuradha, the notion of home has been evolving over the years, in part influenced by technology, precisely the kind of technology that David has already mentioned, like mobile phones and such. How do you think Internet of Things may open up for new conceptions of home?
So in my opinion, traditionally the home is a place which people physically enter and exit, and it has four walls and all of that. But today we see technology that's challenging those strict boundaries, because IoT rests on this idea of being connected or disconnected, which is not actually very different from entering or exiting a physical space. So I can be connected or disconnected to a physical space that I call home, and at the same time I can be connected or disconnected to the people who inhabit those spaces. So for example, I live in Sweden now, which I call home, and I previously lived in other places I called home, and I've also physically disconnected myself from my own home. But however, I'm connected to all these people who I've lived with. I'm also disconnecting with them at the same time. So if you can feel at home in a hotel room with Wi-Fi, or if from a summer house, or you know, from on a, by being on a boat, then we have new conceptions of what it means to feel at home. And I think it has a lot to do with the space and what that represents to you. And somehow in this respect, I feel IoT has creates this feeling of homelessness more than the home itself. So I think we need to focus more on those experiences of what it means to feel at home, like, you know, waking up on a Monday morning or a lazy Sunday afternoon. Those are the things that we really need to focus on, than this idea of four walls and, you know, infrastructures, because they don't really mean anything.
And are there any examples of products or perhaps research projects which you think are good sort of exemplars for this kind of new ways of feeling at home?
Yeah, I think there have been a few attempts at trying to make homes feel more connected in a meaningful way. One of the projects that I like is the Goodnight Lamp, for instance, by Alexandra Sonsino. And it comes close to, you know, the ritual of saying goodnight to somebody whom, you know, to someone whom you really care about. And there are other projects, for instance, the Bring Joy campaign by IDEO, which made these excellent products like the Sincerely app or the Tickle Clock, which sort of take this brief about how do you make Mondays more joyful. And I think that's the sort of future that I think IoT should invest in.
And then at a certain point, does it become sort of really then a focus exclusively on relationships? Or do you think there's other things going on when we talk about home in a sort of everyday sense, mm-hmm. which are also relevant?
Yes. So there's relationships in general between human beings, but there's also relationships that you create with your objects in your home. So, for instance, your sofa, your bed, your, you know, photographs of your family. So these are things that also you start connecting with, and you do that over time. So I think there is some element of timeliness that is important in IoT as well, for you to feel at home with something.
I'm aware of some projects in, I guess, ubiquitous computing area where they attempt to locate digital artifacts, so like these digital photos we're taking and things like that, back into the home and somehow give them a presence in the home. Do you think that's sort of a part of how IoT is of going, is also kind of bringing the digital back into the physical home as well?
Yeah, I think it's an important part of mixing the digital and the physical, because we need to take advantage of that. If things can change through experiences, then why shouldn't we do that?
And if we were to narrow our discussion a little bit just on sort of families in that sort of general sense, and of course there's no set formula for how a family lives anymore, especially in sort of the Northern European context. David, what do you think the Internet of Things might offer us of a Swedish family?
I mean, from an interaction design perspective, I think the first question to answer is the one question you were trying to detach, which is, what is a family? One of my first exhibitions as an academic in 2007 at the School of Design of Samsung, I asked the students there to try to challenge the traditional idea of Korean family. It was very, very hard for these people to move away from this idea of the classic family with both parents and a couple of kids sharing a common living space, until the kids became pretty old and they would eventually get married and move out. That is entirely different here in Scandinavia, as you mentioned. I mean, families are a lot more segregated in a way. Like, relationships don't last as long anymore, and kids move around between houses or places quite often. So I think that's a lot more challenging design scenario. And what that brings to IoT, for example, is that, of course, IoT can allow you, if the infrastructure is ready, which is always my battle horse, to carry with you your digital self. Like, if you have two locations where you're living at, then you can bring your digital self from place A to place B and help you make yourself more comfortable and feel more home, because you have all your files, you have, you know, most of your like memories in the form of pictures or sound or whatever. But then also the infrastructure needs to allow for that and allow for other things. Like if your parents all live together, for example, as a child, it would be really good if you could have both of them present at your room, no matter where your room is at. I think the big issue there is that, as I was trying to highlight earlier, infrastructure is not really ready for that. And there is some issues that have to do also with the fact that so much of this infrastructure relies on the end user. The problem for me is that in the same way that there are some things that are considered rights, like the access to water, the access to education, and the access to different things, there is no clear right about the access to digital infrastructure and the access to your digital IoT services. In my opinion, this should become slowly become a right. You know, if more and more of our life happens on a digital space, I think government should start to consider how to offer us that possibility so that that would enable the citizens' lives to perform much better. And that would allow for this more like homelessness concept of home.
So you mentioned some of the ways in which Internet of Things type solutions could sort of, if you like, grease the wheels a bit of maybe modern family coordination and adaptation to this very sort of multifaceted ways of leading a family. What about sort of, you know, within the home? I mean, some of the more modern examples we've seen of new kind of practices happening in families, like, an old one, I suppose, is a microwave dinner in front of the TV. I mean, that's enabled by a microwave and it's enabled by a TV. And more recently, this idea of having a Netflix and chill, for example, is also facilitated by a certain, you know, infrastructural backdrop. Are we seeing yet any kind of new social practices emerging through the use of Internet of Things type of products?
Well, I do believe there is some things that are happening thanks to the fact of the quantified self aspect behind IoT. Like if your kids have a phone, then you can track your kids' location, for example. Then we also see things like, again, linked to the quantified self idea, people monitoring their own physical performance and then sharing that with their closest relatives or family or friends so that they can actually almost monitor each other and, have some kind of like pressure effect on the results. Like, personally, I need to exercise more. I can quantify my steps. I can share them with my family and they can tell me, I think you need to, go out this Sunday and walk for 3 hours because you haven't been exercising enough this week. So those things is something that is starting to be visible, starting to actually be able of seeing these things because we share this information with others and it's affecting our lives. On the other hand, I have a hard time imagining or having seen other things besides the aspects that Anuradha mentioned earlier, like GoodNet Lamp, which is a very nice design experiment, but we haven't seen that many products in that very same line. I mean, personally, I saw one product before we even started discussing about IoT, which was the alarm clocks designed by Bunny Huang, MIT graduate, or PhD, actually, that designed the Chambi clocks that had an online profile. So if you had multiple Chambi clocks, didn't matter where your Chambi clock was at or how many of them you had going to the same profile, they would represent the same stuff. So in the case I was explaining earlier, if you were a kid from the divorced parents, you could have the same clock in both of your sleeping rooms. And you could have the exact same digital experience in both of them. But I haven't seen very many products like that one, for example, mm-hmm. trying to help you carry with you your digital experience to the next place.
And Anuradha, I mean, you find yourself in a somewhat different conception of home now, living in Sweden from abroad. Do you think Internet of Things has anything to offer you in your situation?
I think being in Sweden has kind of given me a lot of facility to experiment with Internet of Things in my own personal space. For instance, like energy monitoring is really big in Sweden, so I installed a smart plug and now I monitor my energy consumption. And also I started configuring, my lighting conditions in my room. And I wouldn't say it's really helped me connect a lot with my loved ones, but it has had an impact on me to some extent, yeah.
So in a sense, the necessity of IoT of configuration, the fact you have to configure it and make this infrastructure is actually, in a sense, your way of establishing a home of having the lighting conditions that you want and mm-hmm. also being aware and relating to the wider Swedish culture and things like that.
Yeah, exactly.
And I was wondering, David, you mentioned sort of this aspect of maybe control and accountability, so that maybe your exercise, you're accountable for your exercise to other members of your home, to your own children maybe even, sort of inverting that classic power relationship. Can we sort of speculate on some of the perhaps darker sides or implications of this type of technology in what otherwise was a very private, intimate kind of a space beforehand?
Yeah, I mean, I do believe that there is, we're going to learn how to give away or give up some of these private aspects. Like one of them being, as you said, monitoring our exercise. There was a big discussion 4 or 5 years ago when people started to analyze what could be the killer apps for IoT. A lot of companies started to make energy meters. Google started to look at making energy meters. Here in Malmo, there was a company. There was a whole discussion about whether you could do energy monitoring by looking at the LED of the electricity counter. So this discussion was all over the place. There were companies offering the possibility of sharing your energy measurements on Facebook to compare with your friends. The question is, what does it matter? Why should I share with my friends my energy consumption? It might even be dangerous if I show that I have no energy consumption during a certain month, because then robbers might think I'm not home because it's so low. But on the other hand, I think it's extremely educational if the people in the family can look at this data together and can share it. I can discuss about the impact that it has in the global picture of the world. In the past, if you think about it, when I was a child, my dad would never come to me and say, hey, look, David, this is the energy bill for the last month. We're spending this much money in electricity. It wasn't even considered relevant in any possible way. The fact that we can look at this data nowadays in this way and that we can discuss about it, it's opening up for a completely different understanding on the value of the information. And we're looking at sharing it with people that, you know, would not get access to this information before. So as I was trying to say, I think we are going to be ready to give up on some of these levels of privacy. I took energy as an example because I think it's not so private, but we can take a look at the calorie consumption. You know, how much exercise did I do in the last day, or how many hours did I spend reading? I am an academic. I should be reading quite a lot. You know, if in a week I show to be reading only 3 hours, you know, everybody else in academia will say, you only spend 3 hours reading, guy. What are you doing? Right? So I think that will force a change in behavior, I think. I think it will be for good. But on the other hand, you know, we need to be ready to let it go.
And Anuradha, like in terms of relationships and the experience of home in a more sort of qualitative sense, how do you sort of see Internet of Things relating to that or having an impact on that?
I think there's plenty of potential, but I don't think the current products are there yet. But then I think people do things. When people can experiment with their own technology, they can come up with interesting ways of feeling at home, bringing out their emotional side, bringing out their, you know, aggressive side in ways with the help of technology. For instance, I personally sometimes turn on Skype and then I leave it on. And I just like listening to the sound of, you know, my mom cooking, or that's somehow quite evocative for me. So I think there's potential, but then we still haven't tapped into that properly.
And that sounds like a very nice sort of experience that this technology really enables. Do you think there's any sort of anything that other people should be wary of or cynical of in terms of Internet of Things?
Yeah, there's plenty to be cynical about. For one thing, there's way too much expectation on the technology to, you know, do everything for you. So you kind of have to limit yourself and, you know, try to take what is, you know, what it does, and then just not, you know, expect too much out of it. And also there's the aspects of trust and privacy that people also should be quite wary about, who's this data going to, and not be naive about what technology is. They need to understand that technology is also quite biased, and it's, you know, somebody else is, you know, using that data in some way possibly. So I think awareness is quite something that we need to work on with IoT.
David, I know you have some kind of take on how this sort of commercial presence of companies with their services and infrastructures and so forth are kind of coming into the home. Can you explain a little bit about what that's about?
Yeah, sure. Actually, as part of my research, I've been working in trying to understand which is the way IoT infrastructure has been developed and how it's been brought to users. I mean, IoT is not just about being connected. I mean, we say in research, IoT is that everything that can be connected will be connected, right? But that means quite a lot of different things. First of all, it means that you need to have some kind of hardware that needs to be there to enable, for example, getting a sensor, capturing some data from the world and sending it somewhere. Then you need to have some sort of gateway that will take this data from your either personal network or your home network, and then again, transfer it to the internet. Then you need to have some sort of online service that's going to be able of taking this data and do something out of it and eventually have some sort of like artificial intelligence that will compare this data with historical data and mash it up with eventually like open data sources and then make a decision. And then you need some sort of application that or a dashboard where you can see how the data is being treated and which is the outcome of this data. Of course, there is many companies that can do hardware. There is many companies that can do gateways, and there is many companies that can do online services. And the question is, who's going to be doing what? And what we've seen is that the companies that have approached IoT in a meaningful way, like really trying to deliver products to the end customers, they try to cover the whole vertical. They try to cover the device, the gateway, the online infrastructure, and the dashboard and application on your devices. And there's where the problem is, because the way the companies compete is by offering you very cheap hardware so that they can capitalize on the way you use the online platforms. One example of this would be Google. Google makes a lot of money on the data that is online. They don't really make money on the mobile phones that run Android. But by running an operating system, which is a software layer in your device, they're capturing a lot of information that they can make use of in their online services. In the field of IoT, what we see is that these companies, they give you the hardware almost for free, and they try to make money on charging you for a subscription service to this online system. But if these companies don't manage to get enough customers, what happens is that they will end up going bankrupt, and they will end up canceling the subscription services, and you will be left there with a bunch of devices. So this is kind of like what I was explaining earlier. Why should you invest in an infrastructure for your home if you're not even sure that there is going to be some degree of compatibility between your system and a series of different online systems so you can change provider of services in case you need it? Like right now, you have a mobile phone. If the mobile phone is liberated, it's not subsidized to a certain company, you can always change provider. You can change between the hardware and the service. The problem right now with IoT is that there is not that such a separation. Therefore, we see some services that leave the customers out in the wild. It just happened a couple of weeks ago when a smart home gateway was purchased by Google, and they decided to cancel the subscription services to that device. And they left several thousands of customers with a brick home, yet another electric brick that was costing, I think, like $300. Why should you invest if you have, as a user, if you don't have a perspective of a continuity in this device you're buying? My suggestion to this problem has always been that the ITU, which is the telecommunications organization, should suggest a system of standardized pipes for services so that any company could be providing services behind that, so that users will have a choice of moving from one provider to the next. Otherwise, IoT is condemned not to succeed, at least in the short run.
There are also other models like open source development and things like that. Do you think that plays a role in any of this?
I mean, open source is patching the system at many different levels, of course. The issue is that also when we're talking about the online infrastructure, there is many different ways of approaching it. Like if you just want a system that's going to be relying on information, there is a whole series of open source services that you can take, that you can use. The problem is that typically, relying on information is almost useless. Like, whether you want to know the temperature in a different country, and if you want to know the temperature out your window, there's thermometers right now that cost $10 that you can just put there and tell you the temperature out the window. You don't need to go to the internet for that. You know, you want to be able of mashing up which is the temperature in the water on the beach that is 3 kilometers away from your house. So you don't need to make a drive to the beach, you know, or for nothing. You want to drive to the beach because you actually want to spend the day in the water. So that's when it makes sense to have something that, I mean, in this case, just take the temperature. That's just not really telling you much about the temperature. But you would like to know, for example, something more intelligent on top of that, like, well, the temperature on the beach is, in the water is like this, on the beach is like that. It seems to be cloudy. So you're making a mashup of services. You see that, okay, it's getting cloudy. So because of the cloudiness and or the cloud atmosphere, in the atmosphere and the temperature in the water, it seems like it's going to rain. I'm not an expert in meteorology, so I cannot make that decision. But that kind of decision can typically be told to me by an expert system. You know, I can tell you it will rain in the afternoon. That's the kind of part that is not standardized. Yes, relaying the temperature, there's a bunch of open source devices that can do it, but the expert system behind it is a part that's not standardized. And that's what we're lacking.
Certain technology over the years has kind of implicitly brought certain values also into the homes. This idea of mechanized labor and you know, some of these devices which are really meant to help us also kind of, in a sense, enforce a certain way or facilitate a certain way of being within the home, which maybe, you know, we take on in a very unthinking way. And some of what you're describing, this idea of gathering data and tracking things, it does sound like some kind of exercise in efficiency management. The home obviously has certain kinds of values or experiences associated with it. Does Internet of Things miss out on these?
Efficiency has been part of the Internet of Things. Like, you know, a lot of things that we are trying to do is to be better people, to do things in much more optimized ways, get to the bus as quickly as possible within the least time. So I think a lot of applications have been investing in that. But I think there's a lot more that we can actually do with IoT that's a lot more human. Perhaps it can engage people with conversations, I mean, like, you know, between make new communities of people. And even in the home, you can engage in, sometimes you just want to do nothing, and it should be able to give you that space to do that. And, you know, to encourage boredom, for instance, which is like not at all considered as an important value. So there are certain like subtle things that IoT needs to focus on apart from efficiency and optimization.
We've seen within interaction design over the years, there's a lot of more within the field of critical design. There's a lot of really, really good projects that look at technology with different eyes. And I think a bunch of those examples could be quoted because they don't really look at whether you're connected or not. You know, that the connectivity could be fantastic. We were talking about the Woodnet lamp earlier on, which is a really good example. But you also mentioned the idea of listening to your mom when she's cooking. Mm-hmm. There was an example that was made by some students at the Interaction Design Institute de Brea some years ago that was actually a whole business idea about cooking together. Mm-hmm. That could be put together with this idea of the shopping bag that you order some ingredients to cook. And on top of that, you get a device that will allow you to cook together with some other people while you're each one of you at your own kitchen. And you share the experience of like cooking together. And that also links to this other project that I was working with, which is the Smart and Social project, where the idea was to be able of sharing these experiences of using appliances in the home in an asynchronous way, because the one you mentioned was synchronous. So the project was presenting the idea of like how will you use different appliances based on a collective expertise, collective knowledge on the appliances. And there's where, for example, IoT can do a lot of work, and even into personal configuration you were mentioning earlier. Mm-hmm. Like you were talking about how you would like the like qualities to be. You know, the one thing we're lacking right now is that you could express those qualities using semantic systems. And that will be translated automatically into real data values that will reassign to your light conditions. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not that hard. It's like if you said, oh, I really like this sunset, that in terms of light means very specific light conditions. And you could get already existing lamps, like the Philips Hue lamps, they already can go into any value of the RGB scale, and they could give you a very similar light condition. You know, so it's really about saying like, through an interface or whatever, I would like to save these light conditions, and I would like to get this reproduced at 4:30 every day, no matter if it's the middle of the of the winter where I basically have like no sunlight. So that's the thing I think we are lacking, but that's a potential that exists, you know, that goes beyond the things that we're doing right now.
So both of you are doing PhDs in interaction design, and my background is also interaction design. How do you think interaction design has something to say about Internet of Things in the home?
Interaction design, as we understand it, it's always been trying to look at challenging ways of using technology, whether it's for a more, let's say, functional use of technology or whether it's for a more, you know, exploratory way of using technology. Interaction design has always been there trying to challenge the boundaries of the discipline. And I think there is a lot to be offered in a sense that interaction design, for example, plays with the idea of creating more evocative machines or bringing more to the human experience than the pure function of like connecting somewhere. So I think it would be a good thing to quote a couple of examples. Like I hear, Anu, you have to help me because you're the good one with the quotes. I'm really bad. How was the project called? The one for lonely men.
Accessories for Lonely Men.
Yeah.
By Noam Torin.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. So in that project, for example, there was one that was the CD that was going to be playing sounds in the kitchen. So you will feel that there was somebody home while you were doing other things home. Mm. Or there was the one that was like pulling your blankets while you were in bed. So there is actually a lot to be done in a more haptic way than purely text communication. That's what we're doing now when we are remotely located. If I have to travel, which I have to do a lot for work, but I want to be connected to my kid, I want to be connected to my family in general, there is other ways to bring those connections to me than purely through text message, like WhatsApp right now. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very interesting because interaction design is the field that allows you to explore those. And I can mention an example from Telefónica from Spain, from the R&D department in Barcelona, where they made a very interesting machine that is entirely based on WhatsApp. And the idea was to have conversations between elderly mothers and their kids. It's like, I'm pretty sure that everybody wants to talk to their parents. It's never the right time. So Telefónica had this idea of how to find the right time to get parents and kids to meet. And they realized that synchronous communication was not the right way. But I also realized that parents had issues with text-based communication and they had issues with the ideas behind intrusiveness. Like if I call my kid at the middle of a work moment, it's going to be a problem. So they needed a device that necessarily had to be in the home so the kids could work with that device when they were home. So they had this idea of building some sort of a one-to-one answering machine. As the elderly mother, I could just press a button and record a message, and that would be sent to the other one device. And when the kid would come home, it will see that, oh, my mom left me a message, listen to it whenever she or he wanted, and then answer, and then send a message to the other side. Building something like this from an engineering point of view would have been costing a lot of money. From an interaction design point of view, this was prototyped quickly with a 3D printer and two phones running WhatsApp in a one-to-one link in WhatsApp, and then just press the record button and the play button in the sound part of WhatsApp. Things like this is what interaction design can bring to the table. It can bring these very quick prototypes that can be a really good example for something that can be then mass-produced in a different way.
I personally come from an interaction design background that focuses also a lot on critical design. And so I agree with what David said. I think we have to understand that IoT kind of emerged from a very technology-focused development field. And interaction design has its history not just in technology, but in the social sciences and in other fields like graphic design and architecture, which sort of lends much more interesting lenses to see technology through. And I feel it has a lot to offer in terms of expanding what IoT or technology can mean. So the social side or the softer side becomes even more highlighted when you use interaction design with IoT. I think going forward, this is becoming even more. I mean, I see a lot more research focuses that are being more interdisciplinary. For instance, the IoTAP, the Internet of Things and People Research Center itself combines a lot of disciplines. I think that's something that we should keep going with.
So interaction design is pushing the boundaries in terms of how we relate to technology, new forms of interaction, but then also bringing these perspectives from beyond engineering kind of disciplines. And that sounds like we'll be in for a good future of technology if interaction designers have their hand in that. And at the moment, I mean, in terms of educating the next set of designers who are able to do that and actually work with this technology, how can you relate that to the education here at Malmö University?
I've been teaching interaction design for the last 16 years, both at the bachelor and the master's levels. So the way we approach it, by mixing a series of disciplines that are obviously pre-existing, but also looking at how to create new tools that would enable people to work effectively in this very technified working environment, which is, you know, the creation of new artifacts. So we'll teach people about very basic aspects of cognitive science and helping people to understand how software works, how hardware works, how they can go physical with building objects, how they can make user tests, how they can perform with more traditional quantitative analysis, like making interviews, gathering the relevant data, clustering the information from users, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of work being done here at Malmö University to train people in these different fields. Since you ask also in the masterclass, it's like every masterclass at every university is made by people that come from very different backgrounds. So the idea there is to actually bring together all those disciplines and learn something as we're teaching, something about our tools and techniques in interaction design. And then when it comes to the PhD, well, you know, every PhD is a world, it's a different universe. Personally, I'm working with analyzing when it becomes more convenient to create a new platform than just making a one-off piece in design. Like if I'm going to make a prototype, when is better to just think about making a new platform and not because of the amount of effort and for a more, like, let's say, sustainable and more respectful design, look at whether it makes sense to, you know, jump into, well, I make a platform so that others can also benefit from this, which is something that we do a lot in the open source community.
I mean, in terms of teaching, I think this program, as David mentioned, it offers a lot of understanding of tools and techniques, but I also think it gives you an understanding of what are the methods and to question those methods to understand what you're really aiming for. And I use that a lot in my PhD as well, where, yes, there exists methods in interaction design, there exists methods in, like, computer science, but I would like to combine both and sort of see how I can be critical of that and also be constructive about it. So I look for more counter theories or things that can contradict the status quo, which can help me get to a point where I can start intervening in a certain situation and create prototypes and, you know, deploy them and see how they work.
Well, thank you very much, David and Anu.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.